Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in the studio with me today are Brian and Nancy Williams. Brian and Nancy are beekeepers in Providence, Utah, and we're going to talk bees for the program today. So you can call with your questions or comments at toll-free 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495, or you can go online to upr.org. Nancy and Brian, thanks for coming in. Well, I'm actually kind of excited about this because I remember talking to you at some function several months back, and we ended up talking for quite a long time. So I know we can come up with plenty to talk about during this program, and it looks like we've already got a caller coming in. So the first thing to ask, as we talked before the program, that someone needs to do before they even get the bees is finding out about ordinances. And from our discussion, I've found that a lot of cities and counties don't even have them. So then what do you do?
That's correct, Brian. Without ordinances and you want to keep bees, I would talk to my neighbors just to make sure that they were okay with the idea of having bees close by and are used as an opportunity to educate them some on what bees really do. And that so that they're not living in fear next door, and that a lot of people have a gut check reaction to bees, and so you need to look at that and see how your neighbors are and use it as an educational opportunity.
Well, some of the movies that have come out haven't exactly helped the image of bees, but for the most part, honeybees are not aggressive bees unless you're actually happen to squish them or something. So
yeah, they're really very gentle, and they don't. People get them confused with other yellow and black buzzy insects, like the yellow jackets that want to hang out at your table in the summer while you're having a hamburger. Honeybees aren't like that at all, but I think people are just afraid. It's being afraid of the unknown. You don't know what the difference is, and you think that all those buzzy things are bees. Wasps and hornets and yellow jackets love to sting you. They'll be happy to sting you. But honeybees generally leave you alone if you leave them alone. If you sit on them or you step on them barefoot, you'll get stung. But otherwise, they're not going to hang out and try to steal your hamburger from you.
So when you're looking at the ordinances then, what sorts of things do you see in these ordinances? Or do they differ from one place to the next?
Well, yes, where there are ordinances, they do differ from one place to the next. And the first one is usually acreage or property size constraints. And you're allowed to have so many hives per quarter acre or half acre. Like where we live in Providence, up to a quarter of an acre, you can have 2 beehives in your yard. And between a quarter and a half an acre, then you can have incrementally more. I think it's 4. And in Hiram, you need a half an acre in order to have a beehive within the city limits of Hiram.
What about Hyde Park?
Hyde Park is, off the top of my head, I'm almost sure they have no ordinances. There are quite a few beekeepers in North Logan in the Hyde Park area, and I believe there are really no city ordinances that directly address bees within that area. But it's always safe to check with your the town council or the offices of the city you live in because they're dynamic. They could be changing at any time, and information that I know from 6 months ago may have already changed. Mm.
And you mentioned before the program that Cache County has no ordinance?
Yes. They have no ordinances pertaining to bees other than the state ordinances apply then.
And that Logan has nothing. That kind of surprised me a bit.
Yeah, I was surprised that Logan didn't have ordinances either.
So generally, if you don't have an ordinance to dictate how many hives per quarter acre, half acre, what would you go with? I mean, how do you know that your property is too small for you to have bees or you're too much in a densely populated area to have bees?
You know, I think when you're starting out, there is no way that you would know that. So the best thing to do if you're just starting and you don't know much about beekeeping is to get online and look for some good sources of information. And there are a couple that we're especially fond of. One of the ones that we used, and given this, we had some information. Brian had kept bees before, and he'd taught people how to do it, so he wasn't going into it cold. But still, we spent about a year preparing to get those bees, and we found a place online called Brushy Mountain, which is a North Carolina company that sells bees and beekeeping supplies, which also has great videos and tutorials online, and they're free. So you can learn a whole lot about that if you go to www.brushymountainbeefarm.com. So they've got webinars, in fact, that are live that you can set up and work with, and you learn a lot more about exactly what you're asking.
And all of this is free?
Most of it's free. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
the webinars
are free? Everything there is free, including the webinars.
Okay.
You have to register for the webinar, of course, and Brushy Mountain puts out current webinars all the time, and they bring in national renowned experts on topics, and they have discussions and presentations and handle questions from the web audience, and they are very informative. And then the next thing they do that's really great is they take all these webinars and they put them on a specific site within their page, and you can go there at any time and pull them up and review them and look at them. This is all free.
Yeah.
And they have things from I've had my first hive, what do I do? Or now I've gotten through the winter and this, where do I go from here? And
what do they need now?
And what do they need now? And they have good discussions in that on the interactions of pesticides with bees and the new problems with colony collapse and varroa mites, who are some of the biggest problems with bees. And they bring in experts and talk about those. And it's really a good site, and it's all free.
So what would you say is the ideal place to have bees? Who can have bees? Who should have bees?
I think anybody who has a garden is going to benefit from bees. And one of the things that surprised me, because I've seen so many hives sitting out in people's fields, you know, you have an alfalfa field or something like that, I guess the biggest surprise for me was to find out that a monoculture, like a field of clover, is not as good for honey production as just backyard flower gardens. So the more diversity you have, our neighborhood in Providence is perfect. We're up on the bench. Everybody gardens. There are fruit trees everywhere. And our neighbors who knew nothing about bees have been amazingly supportive.
So were they a little reticent at the beginning, but
they
then
were,
have
no,
completely
they really
turned
weren't.
Around?
Yeah, they okay. Well, they knew that we were going to do good intensive beekeeping, and so they weren't, probably just because we all know each other, they weren't reticent at all. But now what's happened is that they've all benefited so much from the bees that they're thrilled, and they can hardly wait. Some of them do want to add hives to their yard. So,
what did they see different? Why are they so excited about having bees?
Because their gardens produced much more heavily than usual. All their fruit trees had enhanced production. They got more fruit and more flowers because our bees were working so hard, and they were. I mean, we got our bees. Only a year ago, we went down to New Mexico and brought those bees back in a car, which was fun to come back in a car with 50,000 bees in the back seat. But and we put them out in the yard, and they started working on May 1st. And they were out of the hive within an hour after we just opened their what's called a nuke, the box that they came up in next to the hive so that they would go into the hive. They were out bringing pollen back. In less than an hour, we were just amazed. We just sat there and watched them carry all this stuff back in the hive, and I thought, they never rest.
I know that when we were talking several months back, you mentioned your raspberry production, which perked my ears how the berries were bigger and you had more berries.
That's the thing I think that was the most noticeable for me. Because when we had bought that house 7 years ago, it came with the raspberries, and they were pretty wimpy. We had even thought about ripping them out. But raspberries are mean and thorny, and so we kept putting off that little exercise and just left them alone under the cherry tree. And once we got the bees, all of a sudden, we could actually pick raspberries. Last year, for the first time ever, we froze our raspberries.
Wow.
Now, you know, as a raspberry person, that you hardly ever come in with any raspberries if you just have a few.
Eating them.
Because you go out there with your cup and you eat them before you get in, exactly. So, but we have frozen raspberries from our very own bushes, thanks to our bees.
Mm. And so... How much of a row of raspberries do you have that the two of you can
now... row of raspberries. I love that. We have no rows, Brian. We had
wild,
crazy raspberries underneath the cherry tree. So really, it's... What would you say, Brian? Maybe a 10-foot circle of raspberries, if that much?
10 to 12 feet diameter circle.
Yeah. That we've never tended. I mean, we've just let them go. Because we were going to take them out, and now we aren't. So I guess we'll have to figure what we're going to do now. But, yeah, we had wonderful raspberries.
Yeah, I believe our production was at least four times as many raspberries last year as we've had.
And they were three times as big. You know, when you're not taking care of them, they're little raspberries. They may be sweet, but they're tiny. And these were big raspberries like you would get if you went down to the market and bought them.
So basically the bees are just pollinating better than these berries have ever seen pollination before.
No, these berries are just in berry heaven. They've never seen this kind of...
When we first bought the house and moved in, one of the first things, being a naturally environmental-oriented person, there were no bees. We didn't have bees on the cherry tree that was blooming. We didn't have bumblebees around on the plants. We had no bees available for production. If we saw two or three bees and it was an event, I would run and get Nancy and we'd take a picture and a camera and all those crazy things. But there were no bees up there to do pollination, and that's just kind of a result of where the state of beekeeping is and the total loss of bees and of all varieties within not only just the United States but worldwide.
Have your bees swarmed yet? In other words, when the hive gets so many bees in there that they want to split the hive and move on somewhere else, have you gotten to that point?
You know, swarming is a completely natural behavior, and I'm really glad you brought it up because some people are terrified of a swarm of bees. They haven't seen it.
Again, it's kind of a movie thing.
It is.
Swarm.
And you think, and some of them get out the can of Raid and kill them all because they don't know what it is. If you have a swarm of bees, you have a gift. It's like manna from heaven, because if you know how to capture that swarm, you have a hive. You never have a swarm unless it has a queen of its own, and that's what they do. If they get overcrowded in their hive, they will simply take that queen and move out, and they leave behind in the hive eggs, you know, and some other bees so that it can recover and get another. You'll have another hive. But we had a situation for the first time this year where Brian said he thought it was going to swarm.
How do you tell?
Well, you tell simply because of the overcrowding and how many bees are in the hive, especially coming into spring after overwintering. If you've got a large, robust, active hive, and when you open it, it's wall-to-wall bees in the spring, you have a situation there that is quite conducive for swarming, because overcrowding is one of the major issues that instigates swarming. And there are several things you can do to help prevent or reduce swarming. But as Nancy said, it is also natural. And you're never going to stop all swarming.
So do you just have an extra hive that's empty nearby that they can go and explore and say, well, here's a home already?
Generally, yes.
If
you're a beekeeper, you have what they call swarm traps. You can do that several different ways, and you hang those around usually 8 to 10 feet off the ground. It's kind of a nice height number, but they bee clusters end up on the lowest branches on the ground almost.
Or on the back of a car.
On the back of a car if you were watching KFL. That was an amazing
video.
Yes,
that was a nice
and a wonderful outcome for that, really, instead of killing those bees, to have the city find a beekeeper and come and capture the swarm, which is what all you need.
And there are many people here in the valley that are willing and excited to capture the swarms. If you don't know beekeeper, the best thing to do is call your city or the animal control or police officer. They have numbers of people. Another thing would be to contact the Cache Valley Bee Club. And there's 70 members of the local bee club, most of which would be more than happy to come and help you with the swarm.
Is there a Utah Bee Club? So if you live in Washington County, for instance.
A lot of the counties have local bee clubs. There are some bee clubs, and on site, if you go to the Utah agricultural site, and that's the website I forgot to put down, so I can't say exactly, agriculture and food website, and go in there and look around, there's a site there that will give you a number and a contact information to get in touch with people who will come great long distances to recover hives. The problem is that a lot of times when they swarm, they're only in your tree or on your bush temporarily, and then sometimes within 30 minutes or sometimes a day or two, and then they will go up and move, and then usually then it's to a permanent home that they found.
So what are they doing when they swarm and they're only there for a couple hours? Are they basically just sending out some scouts looking for a place to
going out, and what they're doing is, and they're scouting for a place for their permanent home, and they'll sit there and wait until they finally reach a consensus, which they do. It's amazing as to where they're going to end up finally, and then they just all pick up and move to that spot.
So what did you do with yours that you thought they were getting ready to swarm?
I gave them more space. I used a modified technique called checkerboarding, which is where you take some of the filled hives, if you've got extra honey and that in there, and replace them with filled frames, and replace them with empty frames, which gives them a sense of more space that they can work on. And one of the best things to do is in the spring, after they've overwintered, the bees during the winter, they feed on the food, the honey that they've stored, and they move into the upper box of a two-box. Say you have a two-box hive, and they'll be in the upper brood box. And what you'll do is you will rotate those two boxes at the time you are doing a spring cleaning of the bottom boards and out of your hive. So you'll put the box that has the brood and the queen and the bees on the bottom of the hive, and take the box that's essentially empty and set it on the top.
Oh,
and so they just now have they have a whole new apartment to move into also.
Added another floor to the top.
Yes, exactly. And that's kind of how it works. But, you know, even that won't stop them all the time if they're determined. Once they start raising queen cells, if you get behind the ball, it's hard to catch up. You have to anticipate, and once they start raising queen cells and they have capped queen cells that are the swarming cells in the hive, they're about going to swarm on you. There's not too much generally you can do.
Well, and this website that you mentioned before, will that help you in looking for these kind of signs? Because a lot of this is just experience, knowing after you've been through it a couple of times.
I think it helps a lot. And there's mainly because there's pictures, and they say, here's what you're looking for, and this is the idea, and there are videos so that you can look in your own hive and say, oh, yes, that looks like what we're looking at right now. The thing I think that most people who don't know about bees need to remember, and I want to emphasize, is that bees, when they're swarming, are their least aggressive. They aren't, when they're all in a globe of bees hanging from a tree, it may look threatening to you, but that's the time that they're least likely to sting you. So the time that they're the most likely is probably going into the winter when they're getting ready to make sure they have enough food for the winter.
Unfortunately,
so if you're taking their honey.
This last winter, I'm hoping, was not as hard on our bee population as we've had in the past.
I hope so. We did have some loss, and I think everybody that we know had a little, but it was an easier winter than most, a real mild winter.
I think we dropped below zero once here in Cache Valley, which
not
is
like
quite
our usual
odd.
At
yeah.
all.
Yeah.
In general, it was a fairly easy winter on bees. Sometimes if it's warm, though, there's more activity and they consume more food. And if the beekeeper has taken too much honey away from them in the fall for his own use, then they could starve to death. And then that opens up so many more scenarios on feeding and when you have to feed and things.
Which brings up another thing, because I thought one side effect of a mild winter is that spring comes earlier, like it warmed up here much earlier, and our bees were out doing their little investigatory flights and what they call cleansing flights, and there wasn't any food. The flowers hadn't bloomed yet. And so when that happens, beekeepers have to pay attention and continue feeding them. I mean, because you have to give them something or they'll starve to death when it looks like spring is here.
Do you ever have to go to the store and buy some honey to feed your bees?
You know, I don't think you could do that. We never even thought of that. We saved some frames, though. We did save some honey frames over the winter.
Just in
so
case.
That we had about a whole hive box worth of honey frames in case it was a bad winter and they ran out. We never had to get into those.
And that's what I love about honey. It keeps forever.
It does keep forever, and they do. But bees can freeze. They can actually die in their own hive in the winter if it gets so cold because they all cluster within the hive.
And if it's too cold to move, hive?
We did this year, but we probably wouldn't have needed to because it was so mild.
Yeah, the insulation and the wrapping of the hive is as much for wind reduction and draft as it is for heat because the bees don't generate heat like you would think from a hot air furnace blowing heat in. They have what is kinetic energy from their vibration, and they just keep the cluster warm. And the bees on the outside are just slowly moving to the inside, and the whole hive just keeps turning itself.
Rotates
in and out, and they're eating the food that's stored in the honey that's stored on the comb in the frames that's directly under the cluster. And if it's really cold for a long period of time, they can't move to a new area on that frame or the next frame that has honey. And if they consume all of that and it just stays bitter cold for a long period of time, they can starve to death, not from the cold, but from the lack of food. But all you need is for it to warm up a bit during the day, and they can move to a new area within the hive and cluster over a new source of food.
So I'm just curious. Do the bees produce more honey because you're taking the honey? In other words, if you just left the hive alone and didn't do anything with it, would they only just produce enough honey for themselves? Or is the process of being a beekeeper and taking honey, then they produce more to try to replace it?
No, it's just their natural instinct, as far as I know, to just work themselves to death collecting pollen.
Oh, here's more space. We need to fill it up.
Yeah, because and they'll fill up every nook and cranny there is. Either they glue it together with propolis and cover extra openings, or they fill it up with honey and propolis for the purpose of raising and feeding brood to increase the size of their hive, which will allow them to swarm and reproduce.
Propolis, what is that?
Propolis, best thing, it's like pine pitch.
It's bee glue.
And they go out and collect it. That's essentially what it is. They go out and collect it from pitch-producing trees, and they use it to seal up all the cracks in their hive. It glues them together, and it drives beekeepers crazy because
it's hard to get
to get apart and keep them clean so you can pull the frames off. And sometimes you go to pull up a box and it's stuck together and you're trying to lift the whole hive. And so you use these bee tools to pop it apart And then you scrape it down and clean it off and start over again.
Who would have thought bee glue?
I know. I'd never even heard of it until I ran into it.
Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program already. So we've got another half an hour with Brian and Nancy Williams of Providence. We're talking about bees. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go online to upr.org and click on the Programs tab to email us an Access Utah question. Right now, we have the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back with Bee Talk.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Holly Strand. In January, a movie called The Gray briefly flashed across theater screens. The plot pits man against nature. After a plane crash in the Alaskan wilderness, seven men struggle to return to civilization. In the process, the group is whittled down one by one, victims of ferocious and hungry wolves. Author Barry Lopez says the wolf as human predator is a theme that runs deep in the human psyche. Thus, this movie is just the latest in a long line of wolf-eats-man stories. Little Red Riding Hood is perhaps the most famous example. Aesop's fables are full of wolves with nasty intentions. The tale that chills me the most is a flashback within Willa Cather's My Antonia. Riding sleds in a snowstorm, an entire wedding party is attacked and then devoured by a pack of hungry wolves, the bride screaming in terror until she is taken down and finished off. Ugh. On the other hand, we have legends and accounts that praise the wolf as noble and even familial. Many Native American groups revered the wolf for its strength and survival skills. The founders of Rome, Romulus and Remus, were supposedly raised by a wolf, as was Mowgli in Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book. In 1963, Farley Moat published Never Cry Wolf, which led many people to see wolves in a more sympathetic light. So how do wolves regard humans? Are we a creature to be avoided, or are we a dinner entree? Not long ago, a team of researchers examined the data on wolf attacks from a handful of European countries plus North America. From these records, they drew the following conclusions. 1. The majority of attacks on humans involve wolves with rabies. 2. Among non-rabid attacks, most victims were children and, to a lesser extent, adult women. 3. When wolves lose their fear of humans, attacks increase dramatically. 4. Wolf-dog hybrids are innately less fearful of humans, making them extremely dangerous. And 5. Not surprisingly, provoking a wolf is likely to incite an attack. Cornering a wolf or entering a den with pups is not a good idea. The study also confirmed that the number of attacks on humans has dropped dramatically in the last century. This is not because there are fewer wolves, necessarily. It's that the situations leading to attacks are not common anymore. For instance, the incidence of rabies has dropped substantially in North America and Europe. And we no longer send our children out alone to tend sheep or other livestock, an invitation for a wolf attack. Another factor is that legislation has curtailed the breeding of wolf-dog hybrids. Now 40 U.S. states effectively forbid the ownership, breeding, and importation of wolf dogs. In summary, the consensus of wolf specialists is that under normal circumstances, people aren't on the wolf's menu. Bears, cougars, tigers, and other large carnivores are much more likely to attack humans. For Wild About Utah, I'm Holly Strand.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Thank you.
Okay, well, if anyone didn't recognize that as Star Wars, then you haven't seen Star Wars. We have Brian and Nancy Williams. We're talking about bees for the rest of this half hour and how to have them in your own backyard. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Get your questions in early because the time does go by very quickly. 1-800-826-1495 or go online to upr.org. Click on the Programs tab, and you'll see the link for Access Utah. Okay, so we've been talking about how great it is to have bees. What's it going to cost me? If I'm just wanting to get one hive, I want to know, to be prepared, how much am I going to have up front in order to buy all the supplies and things that I need?
You can buy starter hives from many bee supply places. Even locally in the valley, there are some bee supply places. There are two that I know of off the top of my head. And you can get the basic starter supplies in the $200 to $300 range that will get you started.
That include the beekeeper suit?
That includes the beekeeper suit.
Okay, that's very important. You need to have the veil, at least, to cover your face.
But that's just the basic supplies, too. You will find that you need other things or you want other things that make it a little easier to do this, or you're going to want to buy it just as soon as you get started. If your bees are doing well, you're going to have to buy extra supers, honey boxes to store
the
honey, and things like that. So it can, for my tax purposes, our tax purposes last year, I put together the expenses for my tax guy, and it was right around $3,000. But we had two hives, and we got a lot of stuff, and we bought extra supplies so that we wouldn't have to keep buying it because the shipping is expensive if you bring it in. The shipping will set you back quite a bit also. And so it's good to buy locally. There are a couple of sites here in town that do that, and one of them is let's see.
So basically you used your vacation money is what you said during
yes,
the break.
Yes, we did.
There's utahbeekeeping.com and cachevalleybeesupply.com. Both have the supplies that you need for beekeeping. They're located in Smithfield, actually, so you can do that.
So when you go to a store and get a specialty honey that's orange blossom mm-hmm. or you see clover honey on it. You had mentioned earlier that it's not good to have a monoculture for your honey. So right. Why do we have those different kinds of...
That's another thing that the state can regulate. Some do, and that's the Department of Agriculture, which will say what you can call your honey. And there's debates right now about what do you mean by organic honey? What do you mean by clover honey? Essentially, if you get a flavored honey... One of my favorites is a macadamia nut honey that comes from Hawaii that really is just from bees.
I can imagine how much that costs.
it was amazing. We brought some back a couple of years ago, and it was the same price as honey we'd get over on the mainland.
Interesting.
Yeah, we just got it at a farmer's market there.
Now, you told me about a honey, I think it was you that told me about a honey in New Zealand. There's some kind of a honey that's really expensive.
I don't think that I had that. That's one I'm not
okay.
familiar with. So it must have been.
But macadamia sounds really good.
Macadamia was good, and they're all good. And you can pick up that flavor from them. It simply means that most of the honey, of the nectar, was gathered from flowers from that source. So, but clover honey is. I don't know what that means. And if you buy honey at a grocery store, you have to be really careful and look at the label. If it's not raw honey, it could be. Not even honey, because this has to do with international trade laws that are right now in litigation. It's a real, you might have heard, in fact, National Public Radio did a big piece on fake honey that was filling up the grocery store. So if you pasteurize honey, you lose the thing about honey that makes it honey, the heat. Gets rid of it.
But why do you need to pasteurize it?
You don't need to pasteurize it. But because of regulations, or I think really big honey producers heat it because it flows better. And if you have a, When you actually bottle honey, that's a long, sticky operation. We filter our own honey and then we bottle it. And that's what most small producers do. If you're doing that on a big assembly line, it's too slow. Mm. And if you heat the honey, it will run faster. You can fill twice as many jars with hot honey.
So again, the good mantra is to buy local, because
buy local.
Then you don't have to worry about the
Absolutely.
Big producers.
Absolutely. Buy, and we have good honey producers in Cache Valley. So if you're here and if you're somewhere else in the state, there are people are producing honey everywhere. Look for your local people and buy from them.
Well, we have our first caller. We have Tim in Teasdale. Hi, Tim. How can we help?
Yeah, I just recently got a hold of a standard top bar hive. And it's actually, they called it a Fibonacci hive, and I was wondering, well, really, if your guests had any insight into or experience using those kinds of hives.
Okay.
I have a friend who has some top bar hives, and several members of our local bee club use top bar hives, some in combination. They have the Langstroth type hives and the top bar hives. A lot of people like them and use them because it's a little more natural. They don't provide foundation, and the bees provide their own foundation. Usually, if you are collecting honey from the top bar hive, you don't extract that honey. You use what's called the crush and strain method because there's nothing to help support that comb, and if you'd put it in a centrifuge, it disintegrates anyway. As far as myself with any experience, I don't have any experience with that. All of the principles are basically the same. You just go horizontally instead of up with the number of hives in there. One thing I do know is if you're using top bar hives and the bees are building their own foundation, you want the hive level. And by that I mean quite level, because bees build the hives out of the foundation and draw it out vertically, and if your hive isn't level, they will build that comb across each individual frame, and it makes it hard to work with.
The size of the hive was, I was curious about that. I've worked with hives before, the traditional hives, but as far as it seems small, so putting them in line and possibly having two of these boxes per hive, perhaps?
Yeah, either that or you can just take, the people that I know up here have built their own, and they just make them longer to begin with, and then they use a divider board where they stop.
The one I have has the divider board and everything. It just still seems a bit smaller than some of the, or at least what my mental image of how big hives that I've worked on in the past have been.
Right, and that was one of my original observations. But my friends doubled and tripled the horizontal length of those hives, and then just used the divider board and kept moving it back as they needed more room.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Great.
Okay. All right. Thanks for your call, Tim.
Thank you for your time.
You bet. Take care. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have about 15 minutes left in the program. It's 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495, or online at upr.org by clicking on the program tab for Access Utah. Now, on our Facebook page for Utah Public Radio, we had Art. I'm not sure where Art is located, but Art says, "Be aware that southern Utah is infested with Africanized bees. They are markedly worse this year. Natural swarming produces more Africanized bees. Get only non-Africanized bees to raise, or you are infesting your own area. We are bringing in good bees and have some available."
Absolutely. And people are justifiably afraid, I think, of Africanized bees. So your best bet is to get bees from a reputable bee supplier, and there are lots of them in Utah, and there are many of them elsewhere.
So how do you choose what kind of bee to get? Do you get an Italian bee, or
That's
do you
a good
get
question.
A German bee? I mean, I have no idea where
Here's
the different
what varieties. We did. We actually thought, okay, we're living here up in the mountains where we're likely to get cold, and we were anticipating a normal Cache Valley winter, with plunges of below zero in January. So when Brian and I were looking at bees to get, he found some bees that were raised in the same kind of climate in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains outside of Taos, New Mexico. So they were already used to living at 8,000 feet, 9,000 feet, and having bad winters.
I can see this working already. Oh, we're going to have to go to Taos to get bees.
We have to go to Taos, so that's what we did. That's why we ended up coming back with 50,000 bees in a box in our back seat. But we did. We made a trip down there to the Zia Bee Company, and they were wonderful. We've really had good luck with their bees.
So these are European bees?
They are actually a hybrid. They are a Russian bee. We used to joke. I named my queens, you know, for Tsar Inez and talked about knitting them little Russian hats to keep them warm. But they have been very good bees. They're less aggressive than an Italian, which isn't very aggressive anyway. Anyway, I'll let Brian. He's making hand signals to me here. He wants to talk. Go.
No, actually, the Russian strain can be a little more aggressive.
Really? You lied to me.
But I would have never gotten you out to the hive to get started. Actually, through the hybridization and selection process, they are very, very gentle also. Mm-hmm. Well, several criteria are being used for developing our marketing queens now, and based on the colony collapse and all the diseases that have drastically affected the bee population worldwide. And so they're developing what's called mite resistance and hygienic type bees, which are resistant to these diseases to some degree and aids in them surviving. One of the main reasons we selected Zia Bee is they had the same type of management techniques that we like, and that is not using pesticides inside the hives to control these insects, these diseases and insects, using the IPM non-pharmaceutical methods.
Integrated pest management.
Insecticides would be the absolute last resort, and then soft chemicals. A lot of beekeepers nowadays, if they get so bad that they have to use insecticides, just let that hive die and start over.
Do you get any information from the USDA Bee Lab? I mean, it's right here on the USU campus.
We do, and in fact, several of the members are members of the Bee Club, and they come and talk to our Bee Club once in a while. But they specialize here on solitary bees, and so a lot of those are beginners also on honeybees, but they're developing it. And we have a website there with the Ag Extension at Utah State. Now, if you just type in bees.usu.edu, it'll kick you up to their page. And in one of theirs, we have a link in there for honeybees now. And inside there, you can go in and find information on the regulations for the county. In fact, all of Cache Valley, including southern Idaho. You can find not only those regulations, but a generalized targeted beekeeping calendar that has been modified for our general area, northern Utah, which says month by month what the bees are doing and what the beekeepers should be doing and looking for and things like that. So there's a wealth of information on that site, and it's connected to the extension agent.
That's really useful, because I think people think it's like beginning gardeners. You think, well, you only have to pay attention to what's going on while things are budding and blooming and you're harvesting. But you as a gardener know that there's something you have to be doing every month of the year that you should be paying attention to. It's that same kind of calendar, only for bees, so that you know, yes, this is October. What do I look for? What do I need to be doing? How do I get ready for the winter?
Well, and I can imagine that your production for honey is up dramatically in the spring, but then does it kind of taper off as the year wears on?
You actually are harvesting honey at the end of the summer. We started pulling honey last year early in July or the end of June, yeah. which we didn't expect. We really, when we got into this, we got into it because we were so worried about what happens to the world if the bees are gone. What can we do to help? Well, sure, let's have a backyard hive and see what happens. So when we got into it, we didn't anticipate having any honey that first year. And as I said earlier, we installed the hive on the 1st of May, and it just boomed. We actually did have to go in and split that hive at the end of June, and we started pulling honey about that time, didn't we? Because we had the super is the part of the hive that isn't
the brood.
Isn't their house, really, and that's just sort of like their storage closet, and they only put honey up there. So if you take honey out of the super, you're not taking it away from what they need, and you have to do that if you want to keep them from swarming. I mean, it keeps the, you know, it's an organizational tool for the bees.
Yeah.
We all need closets, and that's theirs.
And pulling the honey off the hive was also an old man crutch, because the honey super started getting so high on this hive.
You stacked them up.
I was standing on a ladder to pull these boxes off. And
they're heavy.
I'm 70 years old, and that's just didn't what my balance isn't as good as it used to be, and all those things came together. So what we do is we just keep it at two honey supers, and when one gets filled, we rotate that with a fresh one at the bottom, and as soon as it's capped, we pull that one off and add another one. So we just keep it at two supers, three if we have to go away and can't monitor like that. And then we just store that and extract once a year in the fall. And
because, like you said, it does keep forever. There's honey that has come from just the pyramids that's still usable. So you can pull those supers and put them in plastic storage boxes and keep them until you're ready to mess up everything and do the big extraction and bottle the honey.
I've heard that honey is a natural antibiotic.
It is that, too. It's also a wonderful arthritis drug. Brian can tell you about that. He found that out quite by accident. We went online to see if his experience was something they'd written about, and it turns out it is. Tell him what happened to you.
We were on vacation in Oregon last year, and driving home, I have arthritis, especially in my hands, and my arthritis started giving me trouble, and it got so bad that it was painful to hang onto the steering wheel, even to drive the car coming home. Well, about a day or two after we got home, I went into the hive to do some checking because we'd been gone for a while and check on the honey supers and what I needed to do, and I got stung. And within 10 or 15 minutes, the pain in that hand that I got stung on was gone. And I had no more arthritis trouble in that hand for 5 or 6 weeks.
He was just amazed.
And so I purposely went out again and got stung on the other hand. And the same thing happened. And then earlier this spring, when it was cold and damp, I was having trouble. And I just opened the hive a crack and went and grabbed a couple bees and made them sting me. And it helped. And so, you know, I take care of honeybees without gloves and simply because I like to be able to feel what I'm doing in that, and they don't bother me. Mm-hmm. But if I get stung by inadvertently bumping one with my hand or something, I'm okay with that.
You really don't mind too much.
Yeah, as soon as about 20 seconds of pain is over, which isn't, for me, very bad anyway, I have several weeks of more comfort than I normally have. So
does your body begin to build up a resistance to the bees?
You know, I can't
Some
speak
people
to,
say that.
I can't speak to the medical part and what really happens in your body. But I think just like with a lot of allergies, there are methods that you can use to limit or reduce your reaction to things. And I think that this possibly with the bees also, that numerous times that I was stung in India was a long time ago. But thank goodness I wasn't allergic, which brings up a point that beekeepers should consider, even though no one in their family is allergic, maybe having an EpiPen handy just because people come visit or anything else. And it's just,
you never know how your own body might change.
Yeah, and sometimes, and this has happened and documented also, you go along for 10 years and you're not allergic, and then all of a sudden you are.
Yeah.
And so at least my doctor and most of the doctors I know about were more than happy just to write me a prescription for EpiPens, adult and a child dose that I just have stored at the house for whenever or whatever.
If you need it.
Well, we've only got like 3.5 minutes left in the program. I've got a ton of questions I haven't gotten to. If you have a question as one of our listeners, please do call 1-800-826-1495. That number is good anywhere you listen to us in the continental United States. 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email question through our website, upr.org, and click on the programs tab for Access Utah. Okay, so let's talk about education information that listeners need to go to. There's a couple of books that you recommend.
Mm-hmm.
And Nancy, what are those books?
One's called The Backyard Beekeeper, and it's written by Kim Flottum, Flottum. And the other one is called Hive Management by Richard E. Bonney, Bonney.
And why are these good books?
They're just basic. They're basic beginner's books. They aren't going to swamp you with a whole lot of information that you don't need in
the
beginning.
You're not ready to digest
right.
yet.
Right, and you will maybe eventually get to the point where you want that. But this is just basic step-by-step what you need to do if you want to try to get a beehive going.
And the other one was BrushMountainBeeFarm.com was a good site for videos and things.
Right. Brushy Mountain. Don't forget the Y.
Sorry.
BrushyMountainBeeFarm, all one word, no periods, .com. And that's the one that has all the videos and the webinars.
So as far as the care that you're going to need to give these bees throughout the year, how intense is it? I mean, you want to be able to, for me, I'd want to be able to stay with these bees and help them do the best that they can. I guess you could just leave them alone if you wanted to, but you're not going to get much.
Well, if you hover over them, you can bug them, too. And so the good thing is, it isn't like a daily care. The times that you have to pay attention to them, you really do have to. And in the beginning, we were really kind of worried about making sure we did hive inspections and checked on them at the right time. Didn't have much.
And, you know, give. I kind of recommend that for a beginning beekeeper for a while because they need to learn what's going on inside the hive.
Mm-hmm. They do, but they can also.
It would be fascinating just to understand how everything's working.
And the thing is, it's so fascinating that you might want to open your hive and look in it every day, which is not a good thing.
Kind of like looking to see if the cookies are done yet.
Yes, it's sort of like opening the oven all the time. Yeah. It is fascinating. And, of course, all of your friends who are equally fascinated, and you find out they all are, want to come over and poke their noses in, too.
And you want to take them back and show them.
Exactly. You want to show them what's going on and say, here, look at this. Look at what they're doing.
But I've found that one of my favorite things to do last year was pull up a lawn chair in the shade of the tree about, 15 feet away from the hives, 10 feet away, out of the flight path, which is kind of off to the side, not directly in front. Have some iced tea and sit and just watch. And you learn then by going into the hive what necessary and what's going on outside. You can tell what's going on inside the hive by watching what's going on outside the hive.
So do you ever get your binoculars out to look at them as they land to see if they do their little dances?
We take long lenses and take pictures of them, and they do.
I walk right up to the hive from the side, and I just stand and look at them.
They are fascinating.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having
thank
us.
Thank you for having us.
It was delightful.
Brian and Nancy Williams, beekeepers in Providence, and you'll be able to listen to this program on our website later today. And thank you for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.